This is KPFK Los Angeles, and we are on air live as of Thursday morning, March 24th, 1994. And I have in front of me a book called Vote Scam, The Stealing of America by James M. Collier and Kenneth F. Collier, 1992, Victoria House Press. The premise. Vote Scam asserts the unthinkable. It is a strange and frightening true detective story. It contains fact, film, documents, and visions seldom seen by the public. It is a troubling look at the corruption of the American vote that most Americans cannot bear to believe is even partly true. The authors assert and back it up with daring reporting that your vote and mine may now be a meaningless bit of energy directed by pre-programmed computers, which can be fixed to select certain preordained candidates and leave no footprints or paper trail. In short, computers are covertly stealing your vote. For almost 3 decades, the American vote has been subject to government-sponsored electronic theft. The vote has been stolen from you by a cartel of federal national security bureaucrats who include higher-ups in the Central Intelligence Agency, political party leaders, congressmen, co-opted journalists, and the owners and managers of the major establishment news media, who have decided in concert that how America votes are counted by whom they are counted and how the results are verified and delivered to the public is, as one of them put it, not a proper area of inquiry. By means of an unofficial private corporation named News Election Service, NES, the establishment press has actual physical control of the counting and dissemination of the vote, and it refuses to let the public know how it is done. This book also contends that the theft of your vote, or vote scam, is part of a supposedly patriotic collaboration between federal officials and the news media that began shortly after the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963, when the, quote, responsible American press was persuaded by American intelligence services to hide from the American people the actual implications of the Kennedy murder. My brothers, written by Bernie Collier, my brothers Jim and Ken Collier report this story as if the hounds of hell, as Ken used to put it, were snapping at their journalistic heels. I, too, am a journalist, an editor by profession, and a skeptic by training. Yet, as hard as I have tried not to, I now believe they were actually holding the tail of an elephantine conspiracy that they uncovered inch by heart-rending inch. After reading Vote Scam, the impatient citizen may well ask, why, if there's truth in the charges, are there no indictments? That question is one of many provoked by Vote Scam's reporting, and if Americans actually value their vote, then there will be indictments based on this book's data and documentation. My brothers peeked behind Oz's curtain and into a voting booth where people of power had secret hold of all the levers, as well as all the keys on the computer keyboard. Yes, that's one hell of a conspiracy, and it, as Jim and Ken uncorked it, it doesn't stop there. You may be shocked, annoyed, angry, astounded, or alarmed to find out where and how deep my brothers feel it penetrates. Vote Scam is one of the weirdest trips 1990s Americans may take. My hope is that you will suspend disbelief for a while and read it with an open mind. If it raises questions, you will demand answers. Answers to improper inquiries is what this book is about. It's what excellent journalism in its best days is also about. By Bernard Collier, New York City, 1992. And we have on the line James M. Collier, co-author of Vote Scam. Hello, Jim.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's now 7:30 a.m. out there.
It is indeed. The sun is up.
Okay. Before we attack this story, who are James M. and Kenneth F. Collier?
Oh, my. No one's ever asked me that before. Well, gosh, we're a couple of investigative journalists who went through the 60s and saw the street radicalism and knew a lot of the guys, knew Tom Hayden. I understand he's running for the governorship of your state out there.
Yes, he is.
Grew up with Tom, went to high school, college with him. And when it was over, when the 60s were over, we went to New York City and went to Dell Publishing Company and said, hey, let's do a book called Running Through the System, Ballots, Not Bullets, and see if the concept of running through the system, whether it works or not, because, you know, the Chicago 7 were saying the system didn't work, it let us down. And Dell bought the idea, gave us an advance, and we went back to Miami and ran against Claude Pepper, who was 70 years old. He was the congressman, and he'd been in office forever. And he was the father of Social Security, so he was quite an icon.
He was had been called in his younger days Red Pepper.
Red Pepper, right, because they said he was a communist. He wasn't, of course. It was just a tag that stuck with him because it worked, but he was basically, he's dead now, but he was basically a man who could bring back the pork to the area. That's the nicest thing I can say about him. And useful, much like Rostenkowski, I think, and kept in power for the same reason. So it was an interesting race to go against him, and we didn't spend a nickel. We ran in the street campaign, shook every hand, walked, knocked on every door, had breakfast at every church, and just wanted to know what that was worth on election day. And on election day, that was September 8th, 1970, that's where this investigation starts. And this book is a quarter of a century investigation into how elections are rigged, because on election day, at 3 minutes after 7 o'clock at night, the CBS affiliate there called perfect vote percentages in 250 races. And then 20 minutes later at 7:24, the NBC affiliate called perfect vote totals down to the penny that every candidate would get. And that started the investigation when we went to the television stations and got the readout that they used on air. Every 20 minutes they would give numbers. Indeed, they were doing just that because we verified those numbers. And it said the criteria for calling these perfect vote totals in 20 minutes was one voting machine somewhere in Dade County, Florida. It was actually in Pepper's district, of course, because it called our race. And when we went out to find that one machine, we were told that the League of Women Voters had called back the information, that they were out in the precinct, sample precincts calling back. And when we went to the League of Women Voters, we were told that nobody did any such thing, and the head of the league cried and said, I don't want to be caught in this thing. And we went to the FBI and told the FBI that and said, interview this woman immediately. And we wrote stories, and we had a newspaper then called the Daily Planet, which is an underground or alternative newspaper, I guess you'd call it, along the east coast of the country. Printed that story in various other newspapers around, but the major media didn't. The television stations and the Miami Herald and the Miami News did not ever print a story. And so there was no such thing. And we also had a formula that if there was really just one magic machine somewhere that was so representative of this diverse district, where it was Jewish people on the beach, whites in the middle, and blacks to the west, where could it be? Who could possibly represent all of us so that they'd know every candidate's votes? And we said, well, one voting machine. That would take a formula. A, the vote in the machine, times B, the program that they used at the station, and equals C, the vote total. But an A times B equals C formula means you've got to know two out of three at all times, and of course that would mean you rigged the election. And that's how it all started. And the third station, ABC, WPLG, Channel 10, stands for Philip L. Graham, the husband, the late husband of Catherine Graham, owns the Washington Post. It didn't go on the air at all. It ran a movie for the first time in history. And then 2 years later, in 1972, the exact same process came down. And that was basically the beginning of the investigation. Should I go on with
you? Well,
I can give you time in there, or I can continue on with this saga.
Yes, I think we should just go on.
But, all right.
But what we're told, the reason that generally now the TV and stations can come up with the vote total so quickly is due to exit polls.
Well, we'll get to exit polls. That's the not improper area of inquiry in the United States. No one's allowed to know, but that's later in the story.
Okay, go ahead.
What happened was we had dug so deeply into trying to find out how they could rig this election. They had lever voting machines at the time, which are still being used in 30% of the country. And that's where you go behind the curtain and you pull a lever, and it's no computer. And in the morning on these lever machines, the precinct workers would use keys, open the backs of the machines, read off the zeros in the back to make sure all the candidate counters were set at zero. Then they would close up, sign their name on a canvas sheet or tally sheet. At night, they would open the machines and they would read off the numbers. And they would fill in the front side of the tally sheet and then sign their name one more time. So twice a day they had to sign their name certifying the election. They took these machines because we were trying to prove that the wheels were shaved on them, which is how they could have rigged it. In the end, we proved that all the canvas sheets were forged, but the book is such a good adventure story, it isn't just documentation, that I don't want to tell you how exactly we proved that. They can read that and find out. But they took all these machines out of town.
Okay, we're talking about hundreds of different signatures by different people working in the precincts, and these were all forged?
All forged, right. The FBI said they were forged. Everybody said they were forged, and that they hunt for the forger because we had been thrown off the trail for about a year in there because the head of the Dade County handwriting expert, the one that they use in all their criminal cases and all this guy, they dragged to court. He says, no, these things aren't forged at all. But you could see that they were all gray. I mean, you take 500 sheets because there were 643 precincts, I think, and they all looked the same. They looked forged. I mean, it looked like the same person did it. And in the end, of course, it turned out that the same person did do it. And that's how they rigged the entire election. But they shipped these machines out of town to Marion, North Carolina, and or South Carolina, I can't remember which that was. And they refitted these the backs there with a device called a Print-O-Matic. And this is now being used across the country, and its only purpose is to rig elections. And what it was a roller that they put a piece of paper over the back, and they took the keys away from all the precinct workers and said, you will no longer look in the back of these machines. And this is nationwide now. You can no longer look in the back of the lever machines in this country. And you will crank a handle, and this roller will roll across the piece of paper, picking up the impression on these wheels. Instead of looking at it with your eyes, you'll now crank the paper, and it'll come out a slot in the bottom like a gumball, and you will certify this piece of paper from now on. And so the first time they used it in Dade County, they rolled it, and the paper went the roller went halfway across, and it jammed. And so they called out troubleshooters because there were no keys in the precinct anymore. And the troubleshooters came by, opened the machine, and where there was the roller had not rolled across, the numbers were already on the piece of paper. And so 4,000 precinct workers walked off the job. And the Miami Herald wrote a story saying, well, it was a big snafu, but it never said why. It just said policemen and firemen took over their job. But they didn't want to certify a rigged election. And And that was the third way they rigged elections there, and it was getting rather frustrating for them. And we had gone to the circuit court with all this material that we kept digging up, and they appointed an attorney named the head of the court, named Ellis Rubin, to become the ombudsman. And Rubin is now running for the U.S. Senate down in Florida using this book as his platform. Anyway, he takes this stuff into the state attorney's office, all the evidence. And the state attorney was Janet Reno. And she was the assistant, actually, at the time. She later became the state attorney. And he goes in there, and the television cameras are waiting for him to emerge because he's a real media type, you know, like Jerry Spence or Norman Belli type. And he comes out, and he is literally gray. I mean, his face is just fallen. And he says, Janet Reno has told me to tell you that the statute of limitations has run out on the crime. And then he runs out of the building. Well, excuse me, I have a cold here. The statute, what happened is Reno admitted there was a crime and that she wouldn't prosecute the crime and she would protect the elections division's election rigging, and she did that her entire stint up until the time she became the U.S. Attorney General of the United States, where she's protecting the Justice Department attorney who's in charge of prosecuting election rigging in the United States. His name is Craig C. DonSanta. And so the statute of limitations, of course, at the time had not run out when she said it had, and there was no such thing anyway. It was an ongoing crime. And that was the beginning of the investigation. In 1982, the Republican National Committee put out a reward offer nationwide, and it said, we know there is election rigging in this country. And that was printed on the Armed Forces Network and all the newspapers. And it said, we'll give you $5,000 if you can get an arrest and conviction of anyone, and we'll pay it. So we were told that the League of Women Voters were up in this bunker-like building in Dade County called the Data Processing Building. It was out in the Everglades, far away from everywhere in the dark of night. Nobody was allowed to see how your vote was counted, but they were up there punching thousands of holes in the computer vote card, because we had converted now to computer in Dade County. And so we got a video camera, and we were told we'd be arrested if we tried to get in, which, of course, it's illegal. You can have a secret vote in this country, but you can't have a secret count. But everywhere the computer is, the count is secret. And but we said this building had guards, it had television cameras and cops all around it. And we got in anyway. And we got upstairs and we caught the league punching thousands of holes in the cards using illegal pencils issued by the Elections Department, by the head of elections, David Leahy. And when they got done mutilating the vote card, it then went into a room called the BMX room, which is the ballot multiplexer. It's a floor-standing machine. It's a hopper. You put about 1,000 cards in one side. A light source sucks it past. It sucks past a light source that reads the holes in the card. It puts it onto a magnetic tape, computer tape, and then it comes out the other side. Well, there were 9 machines, but the videotape shows that 8 of them were totally standing empty. Nobody, the electricity wasn't even on. And on the 9th machine, a guy was, we videotaped him taking a card from the already counted side and put it back to be recounted, which is a federal offense. But when the FBI stop actioned that, you could see that the holes in the card were running the wrong direction, and it wasn't even a vote card. It was just a scam operation going on in this room that the public was not allowed to see. And not a single vote was counted in Dade County that night, but 250,000 votes came out. And we took that information to Janet Reno, and she refused to prosecute. And then, in 1987, I found that someone called me. I was writing for a newspaper in Dade County, and I got a tip that the man who was running for mayor of a city called Opa-locka was printing his own ballots. And so I went to his print shop, and there they were on the floor, and I grabbed two boxes and I ran out. And they chased me in the end, and I took them to Janet Reno, and she had me arrested for grand theft. $1,500 bond, but she never prosecuted. When it got to court, she dropped the charges. So, Janet Reno is a woman who really belongs in federal prison for obstruction of justice and protecting a cartel of election riggers nationwide. We also went to Cincinnati. Eventually, this whole project went nationwide, and we went into cities around the country.
Now, what is the project?
The project, by this point, became, we were the Ralph Naders of vote election rigging, and we were writing articles for various newspapers in the country, and so people would call and say, hey, you know, we got problems in our city. Would you come here and see what you can find? And one of the cities was Cincinnati, Des Moines, Iowa, Dallas, places like that. But in Cincinnati, we caught the League of Women Voters using tweezers to tweeze out a slate of polls. What happens is the IBM had a thing called a porta-punch, and they would take a pad of 50 vote cards and push down on the porta-punch, and it would punch out a slate. In this case, it was seven candidates. But the little piece of chat, it's called, the hole in the center that it falls out when you punch it, wouldn't fall out because there were 50 cards. It would just blister into the one below it. And so they needed tweezers to pull off these little blisters. And when we videotaped that, the next day, we gave it to the television station there, Channel 9, and we went on WCKY, the Jan Michelson show. He's now out in Des Moines, Iowa on WHO. And Jan, who'd never seen us before, he says, hey, this is fascinating. And he put us right on the air. And he challenged the election supervisor, Elvira Radford, to answer this outrageous charge. And she couldn't. Instead, she resigned the next day after a 20-year tenure as election supervisor. And that was the anatomy of a crime, shall we say, all of that.
Okay, well, part of this anatomy, a disturbing part of this anatomy in the Dade County and then again in Cincinnati, is the League of Women Voters, which is one of our most highly respected institutions for decades. And when I first started this book, I felt very uncomfortable about any indictment of the League of Women Voters.
Right, but we ended up suing the Republican National Committee for refusing to take us to the Justice Department like it promised in the reward offer. We sued the League of Women Voters for lobbying. I'm going to cough. New York called lobbying the various people involved not to, like the RNC, not to go further with this because they would be indicted. We sued the Justice Department because when we went to the Justice Department with a videotape and a Washington Times reporter, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter named Gene Gault, the prosecutor, Craig Don Santo, refused to see the video, and he threw us out of his office and never come back again. And we sued ABC News for being part of it. And all these cases we won on the lowest level, the low federal court level in Washington. The judges said, you guys have a case here. So it went to the appeals court level, where Ruth Bader Ginsburg was one of the two judges who said, you guys have a case here, and go back to a hearing, because they all appealed it. She's now, of course, a Supreme Court justice. But 60 days later, just before we were going to go to a trial, a memo appeared in the file. It was on unbonded paper. There was no official time stamp on it. It had droodles on the back of it. And it was written, and it said that the prosecutor had a prosecutorial discretion not to see the evidence, which, of course, is a lie. He had prosecutorial discretion to see the evidence and not act on it. And that memo was written by Antonin Scalia. And it was before he became a Supreme Court justice. He was also on that second Court of Appeals. And it was a deal that he had made with the Republicans that's our theory, and we sued Scalia over this, so we put our money where our mouth was, to become the Supreme Court justice over Robert Bork, who was his mentor and his teacher at Yale, and Bork was the guy who did the Saturday night massacre and the Watergate thing, and Scalia was in the Office of Communications then in 1972. So they all go way back and owed each other lots of favors, and Scalia actually screwed Bork on this one, and they made him the Supreme Court justice because he was willing to put that illegal memo in. And when we sued him, we didn't let it just stand. His corporate counsel, Edith Marshall, said, "Everything you're saying is absolutely true, only he's a judge and he can do whatever he pleases," and that ended it.
Now, this suit originally that started with a suit against the Republican National Committee, they had advertised that there was vote fraud, that they had heard that rumors that there is vote fraud, and they were asking people, anybody with evidence of vote fraud, to come and report it to them.
Right, and if you could get arrest and conviction of anybody doing it, you would get $5,000.
And they would also...
thank you to the justice. It said, "We will." The word "will" is very important for lawyers who read this book, because we got star chambered in Washington. We were definitely headed for pretrial on one of these cases, and the judge drags us into a back room, a courtroom that they had to dust it off and hadn't been used in 10 years, and they dragooned us in there.
It was a back building, actually.
A back building, right, in Washington. And he, at that point, says the word "will" is a prediction word. It is no longer a demand word. It just shattered, you know, 500 years of common law that the word "will" is demanding in a contract. He says, "Well, it's like it will rain. It's predictable." Because the contract said, "We will take you to the proper authorities at the Justice Department who will proceed." And, of course, the RNC refused to do that once we brought them this damning videotape and all the material. And the tape is really, in case anyone is skeptical out there, the tape was so good that Pat Robertson and the Christian Broadcasting Network, his 700 Club, paid $2,500 to show it on his show, and he did it.
And he actually showed the tape.
Showed it right on his show, and then he ran for the presidency and never said a word about it after he showed the public how bad. I think he used it like a lot of people are using this information to blackmail others into saying, "Hey, I know what you're doing. I know who you are, and I want to win or I'll blow it on you." Of course, he didn't win.
Well, but he has he now has a position in the elections process.
Yeah, and he ended up buying, wait till I tell you about the networks, guys. He ended up buying UPI. He knew so much about how it worked. Maybe I'll tell you that right now.
It only cost him 35 cents, or what is it?
What?
And UPI only cost him 35 cents?
I know. Anyway, what happened was, is in 1964, after Kennedy was shot, the television networks went to the United States Senate, who is the official vote-counting apparatus in the United States for the presidential election and the congressional elections, and said, "We will not talk about the Warren Report. We will make the Warren Report the official report. We won't refute it. If you give us the right to be the official vote-counting apparatus in the United States." And the Congress did that. The Senate actually did that. And they formed a pool called News Election Services. Now, I know that most people think that at 7 o'clock at night, when Rather and Jennings and Brokaw go on the air and say, "We're the first with the most, we outscoop everybody," that they're really competing, but they're not. And they haven't since 64. They have a computer on 34th Street in New York and a bank of computers on the 13th floor of the World Trade Center, which we infiltrated with Geraldo Rivera's hidden camera. But that's an interesting chapter in the book. I don't want to get into that at the moment. But anyway, they have these banks of computers, and they have the United States gridded off. 110,000 precincts, and they use the League of Women Voters like they did in Miami in these 110,000 precincts, supposedly calling back information. And they and that computer, that mainframe computer on 34th Street, ties in to all the mainframe computers in the United States. And it can change votes at will. There's a phenomena that many people have seen in this country, and it goes on everywhere, where a candidate is ahead. He's usually the good guy, someone who would make a difference. And the computer surges and goes out in the television and say, well, we have lost the computer, but we're going to project. And when the computer comes back, that one candidate has turned around, and he might have been winning 60-40. He's now losing 55-45.
They do that in Mexico, too. The computer,
right.
Though it takes longer to bring the computer back there than it does here.
Right, so that's a phenomenon that goes on. And so the television networks now control the vote in this country. And one other phenomena. There are groups of people in California. There's a group called DFM. And out in the Midwest, there's a group called Fiddler and Chambers. And they go into cities across the country, Fiddler and Chambers and in California to the state. And the election supervisors haven't the foggiest idea how to program their machines. They're just political hacks in most cases. Like, they don't know anything about computers and they never went to computer school. So they need somebody to run this massive machinery. And, they hire these companies. And these companies come in and for hundreds of thousands of dollars per election, they, program your computer, and then they count your vote. And so we have an open letter to Ross Perot there in the book saying, hey, Ross, you want to become president of the United States? Just go to Fiddler and Chambers or DFM or companies like that. There's about a dozen of them. And pay them a couple $1 million, and they control the vote count nationwide. It's no longer in the hands of the people. It's in the hands of these private companies. And, of course, he never answered the letter. All his chapters in New York and Virginia and New Jersey and all we all faxed it to him and all, but Perot is absolutely like Howard Hughes. He will not talk to anybody.
Now, I want to separate the fact from theory here.
Okay.
Now, it is true that the news election service counts the votes all over the country.
Right.
That they are not answerable to anybody. There's no paper trail. There's no electronic trail. There's no auditing. There's no checking.
Right.
They have no PR. They don't grant interviews. They don't allow, against the law, they don't allow anybody to watch the counting procedure.
Right.
That is fact.
That is fact.
Now, the theory, which would be called a conspiracy theory, which was shared or introduced by the late Mae Brussel, who we've used to run her program on this show.
Uh-huh.
And it is her theory that the news media agreed to support the Warren Report and not challenge the Warren Report, and in order to get this NES, the News Election Service, apparatus together to control the vote. And the news.
Well, I was also told that by David Walper.
Oh.
All you people know, he said till 1995 that's in place, and unless it's changed, things could change in 1995. But the last time I spoke to him, he said it was until 1995, and then things might change.
Well, that would be, I wonder what it would change to.
Well, they could now admit that there was a front gunman. The other thing that Mae Brussel said, and it's in the book, is that, because Ken was on a radio show out in Santa Cruz, San Francisco area, and Mae Brussels was listening in, and she said, look, if you want to find the real roots of all this, go to Dallas. And, of course, that's what started that whole NES series. But Ken went to Dallas, and he explored the crime scene. And that's an interesting chapter in the book because no one else has ever written about this. And at the crime scene, right where the trestle that crosses the street there where Kennedy was shot, and it meets the grassy knoll, the train trestle and the grassy knoll and the picket fence, right at the corner where the two meet, there's a cistern there that's 3 feet deep, and or I think it's like 6 feet deep, and 3 feet wide, and there's a giant 18-inch hole that leads down underneath the grassy knoll into a 6-foot pipe, a sewer pipe that leads to the police station. And when we had an ABC News crew go there and videotape this, it lined up exactly perfectly. You could be in there with a rifle, stick it underneath the slats of the fence, and it, perfect lineup for the Zapruder film. It would have hit Kennedy exactly right in the right temple. And we took that to Nova in 1988, I think, or whenever one of their anniversary was, and they bought the film, that bit of video from us, but they never showed it. They were not allowed to use it.
Well, they showed another pathetic apologia for the Warren Report.
Right. The only thing that they're willing to say now and admit is that it probably was a conspiracy with CIA and mafia and all kinds of people that Kennedy had teed off, but they're not willing to talk about that cistern over there. And Conover Hunt, who was in charge of the Book Depository Museum now, before this all came out, said, you better not show that video anywhere or you'll become the enemy of all of Dallas. And but, of course, we have that video, and it's available to be seen.
Well, and be that as it may, the theoretical beginnings of this, and it sounds cogent. I have, and a lot of us have been looking for an answer, why the media in general is so incredibly blind and lame with reference to the JFK assassination, and just like unanimously stupid.
Right.
And then the Oliver Stone film comes out, and you had this unanimous condemnation before the script was written.
Well, another part of the thing is that Stone never got it in. I mean, this is original research in our book. When we tried to find out who built the railroad trestle, and we tried to get the plans for it, they're hidden under national security, as is a great deal of our own file on election rigging in the United States under national security. And we explain that in the book. Why is election rigging under national security? But that, how that bridge was built, was under national security, but it was built in 1936 as part of a WPA project, and the builder of the project, the man who knew the cistern was there, the man who knew that Kennedy was being taken down a cul-de-sac where no FBI men were on any buildings and where they were all called away from the car. A fascinating bit of video, if anyone has seen it, where just before the shot, all the FBI men are told to immediately get away from protecting the car. The man who knew all of that and who built the cistern was Lyndon Baines Johnson.
But he wasn't the draftsman.
No, he was in charge of the project. He was a young, up-and-coming young man in 36, and he was put in charge of that work project, WPA project.
Well, I didn't know this thing about the Secret Service people getting away from the car.
Oh, yeah, there's great video on that. You see them being ordered away from the car.
Does Robert Groden know about this?
I don't know, but it's out there, and it's available. Do a little checking. You'll get to see it.
Okay, well, I have Groden's new video, so I'll have to check that.
Yeah, you see them being called away, and they're ordered away. You see the guy, was it Clint Hill, the guy who jumped on the back? I mean, they know. They all know. They were all part of it.
Okay, well, this is the beginnings of this setup of the National Election Service, the Vote Counting Service, which is actually a consortium of NBC, CBS, ABC, AP, UPI, and
CNN, the Washington Post, New York Times, and remember, what's his name? Pat Robertson bought UPI right after that. So he knew something.
Well, he knew it from the video that he showed.
Right.
Christian broadcasting. So the only Christians have been able to see the your video on television.
That's true. I'm going to be speaking around the country now. I've been doing back-to-back radio on this thing for the last 3 months. We sold out the first 10,000 books on this without a bit of television or print media. Just word of mouth from cities that there is trouble in Las Vegas and Phoenix and Florida and New Orleans and Waterloo and places like that, where people are using the book to try to fight the computer or the printomatic in their town. And the book is sold out, where they're going into their second printing. And so now I've decided it's spring, it's nice, it's the worst winter New York ever had, and I want to hit the road and speak across the country and show the video, things like that. So if people want to see me speak, get a crowd, and I'll be there.
Oh, well, I think we can probably make an arrangement here with the show.
I've gotten calls up there. Somebody, John Rappaport, he's running for Congress or something. He called me and wanted me to come out, and I think he even lined me up with you.
That's right. John called me and told me about the book.
All right, I just remember that.
He gave me a rundown, and he mentioned the News Election Service and the League of Women Voters, and I sort of bristled. If it was anybody but John, I would have said, oh, this is all BS.
So
the
League of Women Voters. John is a good man. I mean, I've never met him.
Yes, he is an excellent man. And I followed his advice, and I got the book, and I read it, and I'm even speaking to one of the authors, James M. Collier, co-author with his brother Kenneth F. Collier. The book is called Vote Scam: The Stealing of America.
Right, the book is available, by the way, I think, out at the Mandela Bookstore in Santa Monica. You can get it at other bookstores, but that's one that wants us to tell you for sure that they carry it at the Mandela Bookstore.
Okay, and it is generally available at...
Oh, yeah, you can get it. Just tell your bookstore to order it. It's only been out 6 months, so it's Baker and Taylor, if they ever ask, is the national distributor. If your bookstore says they can't get it, just say call Baker and Taylor, and they'll get it for you.
Baker and Taylor.
Victoria House Press in New York City. That's the publisher, Victoria House Press, at 67 Wall Street. They can get me there. It's in the phone book.
Okay, and the Mandela Bookstore is in Santa Monica at Santa Monica Boulevard and 6th Street in Santa Monica, and their phone number is area code 310-393-1953. Mandela Books, area 310-393-1953. This is a paperback book. The normal size paperback is about 300, almost 400 pages. Vote Scam: The Stealing of America, James M. Collier and Kenneth F. Collier. This is KPFK Los Angeles, and we are on the air live with Vote Scam as of March 24th, 1994. Now, there was a period in the recent past where Janet Reno, and another person that I'm disturbed that there's this kind of accusations of this activity, but she had she was very vulnerable when she was picked, the third selection, as I remember, picked to run for attorney general of the United States. She was nominated by President Clinton after his first choice was knocked out of the box because she didn't pay her nanny's taxes, and the second one was knocked out of the box because she didn't pay her nanny's taxes, and then Clinton chose Janet Reno, and Janet Reno never had a nanny, so she was evidently okay. But then there's this vote fraud that she knew about, that she declared the crime existed in Dade County, but that it had passed the statute of limitations, which maybe didn't exist, and nothing was done. So here's Janet Reno, and she's going to be attorney general, and I'm sure all her enemies, the Republicans and the anti-women and the anti-Janet people, were all had their antenna out looking for anything about Janet Reno that they could use to knock her out so she wouldn't be attorney general and they could get somebody like a niece or somebody that they would like. And so weren't there...
Yeah, well, I know what you're driving at. We tried to testify against her. Everybody who knew her in Miami, and I knew her as a kid, her father was one of the greatest investigative reporters in Miami, the best police reporter, Hank Reno. And he taught me everything I know, the roots of how to investigate and look into documents and find facts. And I knew her when she was 19, and the people who knew Janet well tried to testify against her in Washington, and they refused to let any of us. And I was prepared and went down there, distributed. The book was in galley form then. It wasn't even in print form. It was just galleys. And we gave it around to the senators, and I handed it to her sister, who is 6'7" like she is, I think, this giant woman. And everybody knew it, and Biden refused. They refused to allow any of us to testify. It was a total railroad. And the thing with the nanny gates, that was all a setup. They wanted Reno, that these other two got in there. They had to find a way to get rid of them, the plan, because Hugh Rodham Clinton, Hugh Rodham, I mean, works down as a public defender out of Reno's office, and she was part of the girl network. I use that term loosely. And they all wanted her. Plus, Alice Rubin had written a letter to the attorney who was the ombudsman there, had written a letter to Attorney General William Barr. And we had a petition in the back of the book that had just worked as they had, I think it was Kimball Wood first or Zobair, I don't know who came first, and it was in the galleys saying that it was a petition to the Attorney General saying that, you know, you got to do something about this. So when people buy the book, it's in there now, but it's to Reno. They would send the petition to the Attorney General to do something about vote rigging and send a copy to Victoria House Press in New York. And so when the first one, Manny Gate, got her, then the second one came up. So we called the printer and said, well, change the name. I think it was Obeyed. And then when she got knocked out, we just it came Janet Reno, and so now the petition is to Janet Reno. When you buy the book, please fill out the petition, send it to her, and send a copy to us, because we're building a file.
And so there's a real strange poetic injustice here, because when the book was written, you have these petitions in the back, and originally they said to the Attorney General,
right?
Now there's this stuff going on, and please look into it. And then Janet Reno became the Attorney General. And so you write about her in the beginning, and you have a petition about her or to her in the back.
Yeah, it's amazing. There was a guy, I can't remember his name now, who came in the National Football League, and every game, when they were losing by 3 points or 2 points, he'd come in and kick a field goal, and he kept kicking them longer every time. It's famous. Your sports people know who I mean, but I can't remember the name. It was the same thing. It was like a miracle. God would say, hey, you know, we'll bring this guy in and do it. Well, here's Reno pops up after we'd written this whole book. How about this corrupt woman in Miami who is obstructing justice? And just before we go to press, becomes the main villain in our book, and we get to put on the cover the book that indicts Attorney General Janet Reno. And I want people to take this really seriously. We've got to get rid of this woman. And the people have got to stop voting in this country. That's one of the things I want to tell them. You just keep playing into the hands of these people by going out there and thinking that the only civic duty you have is to vote, and I don't care if it's rigged or not, I'm going to go vote. They've got to read this book and stop voting. Like, I took this in galley form, even before galley, I took it in first draft form where it was only documents, to Tom Hayden. We're out in Santa Monica there. And Tom Hayden knows all about this. And he said, Jim, you know, because of the Vietnam War stuff, I'd be too much baggage to do anything. And now he's running for governor. I think Tom, who I grew up with and once considered a friend, is a man who is opportunistic. I'd like him to get a copy, a tape of this show. I think he's a man who would be, who has the potential to be great, but is corrupt. He knows this is true. He knows he could stop it. He knows he could stop DFM. He knows his word could cause an investigation. Instead, he's willing to become the beneficiary of rigged elections to further his ambitious career. I've known him since we slept at each other's house as kids.
Do you think he thinks that? Do you think that he could stop it? A a California legislator where you have...
Well, running for governor. It puts him one step higher. He's trying to run for governor.
Well, still a state official. When you... This is a... This
yeah,
is
because
a
there are no liberals left in this country. And if there are, you name me one. Tom may be considered the last one. And I can't get the liberal side of the game board to play at all. They don't exist. The right side, the right, the patriots, the Christian right, all are active players in trying to stop election rigging in this country. The Spotlight, which is a right-wing newspaper, but the best investigative newspaper in the country, bought 52 stories from us in the 80s. We sold it to them. Because it was the only paper that would put it out, and that's how the people across this country knew that we were investigating, because they read our series in there, and they would call us into their town and say, hey, it's going on here. But yeah, I can't find anything left at all in this country. I can't. It doesn't exist. I don't believe there is a left. There's a middle, and there's a right. Maybe Jerry Brown, but he's in the book, too, as you read there, and... we did everything we could to get to Jerry Brown, and he fired his man, Eli Mellor. And if Eli or anyone knows him is out there, please call me at Victoria House Press in New York, because Eli, when he was running Brown's campaign, went to Brown and said, this is, you know, I've never read anything like this. Read this book, and you've got to do something about this. And Brown actually went on television and said to Bernard Shaw on CNN, that the elections are rigged and the TV stations knew it in advance. I forgot the exact words, and Shaw took umbrage with that. But fired Mellor immediately for trying to press it too hard.
Well, Shaw hadn't read your book, evidently.
No, but Shaw knows. They all know. They all know NES. They all know... my daughter goes to a university here in the East, and she has a political science professor who says, you know... The whole country was Democrat in the 60s, and the whole mood of the country was liberal and you know, the hippies and Democrats were controlling, and yet we got a Republican president. I don't understand it. And she's giving him a copy of the book now to say, look, here's the key to it. It'll make everything clear to you now.
Yes, as a matter of fact, but it's a hard process to go through. Now, this list, I made a list of the people that you contacted at this point where one your nemesis, Janet Reno, is up for appointment for Attorney General, and that anything as serious as a nanny gate or more might knock her out of the box. And you contacted with this story Jay Mader of the New York Daily News,
right,
the Wall Street Journal, Ted Koppel, Larry King, Helen Thomas of UPI, mm-hmm. Nina Totenberg of NPR, Associated Press, Mike Wallace, Washington Times, Evans and Novak, The Village Voice, Pete Hamill of the New York Post. They all refused the story.
Pete Hamill was the only guy of all of it who said, hey, this is really good. The others knew it was good but couldn't do anything. Tim O'Brien, how about the story about him in there, who he made calls and said, wow, this is a terrific story, and he couldn't do anything. He's the ABC Supreme Court correspondent. On ABC, you see him every Monday after the Supreme Court rules. But Hamill, he immediately saw it, and of course, that was when the Post was going through the Abe Hirschfeld thing, and then Hamill left. So it just seems like they gave us Reno, but they took away everything else, every little break we'd get. Mader thought it was a great story, and he knew about it because he had been on the Miami Herald, or Miami News, I can't remember which. I think it was the Herald during that time, and he was then on the New York Daily News, and he knew about it, and he tried to get it in, but the city desk, for some reason, wouldn't let it. So you cannot rig an election in this country without the television stations and the establishment press of the town cooperating. It's the L.A. Times. As a matter of fact, some of the best material we got was from the chief investigative reporter for the L.A. Times. Rosenzweig was his name. He got me a lot of stuff out of LexisNexis, which is the computer base for newspaper people, if you punch up vote fraud and you get 31 or 50 pages of everything done in the country. And the L.A. Times has done some incredible stuff, agreeing with everything we said, but it never went any farther, and he couldn't get it to crank it up. So newspapers are absolutely part of the rig. And anybody who doubts that, take this book to the L.A. Times and say, hey, let's do this story, and you'll find out what'll happen, or to the television stations. I almost got on KABC when I was living out in Beverly Hills for a while when I came out to see Hayden. But I left California before I got on, and then I never got back to that, a talk show on KABC. I can't remember who it was. But it's a real struggle to get past any establishment press or television station, because they could stop vote fraud in a flash in every city.
Well, they're controlling the vote fraud.
But they're controlling the vote fraud, right. So these newspapers are I don't want to use a pejorative word there. I could use some gutter words on what they are, but they are. And they're just self-aggrandizing. And the reason that is because they are the power. There is nobody bigger in town than a newspaper. You could be Michael Eisner and a newspaper could come along and savage you. So on the game board of life, the newspaper is the power.
More than the television?
The Chandlers are getting rich off of what they know.
More than a television station?
Both. Television stations equal. The news departments of television stations are just ambulance chasers and rip and read artists. That's all they are. If they wanted to investigate vote fraud and how it's done, they could put an end to it in a minute. But they won't do it.
And in the meantime, in Southern California, our elections are...
One of the worst corruption in the country. I don't think there's been an honest election in Southern California.
News Election Service, they're in Irvine.
Well, no, that's DFM.
That's DFM.
Right, that's the company that goes out and counts the vote, like in L.A. I investigated L.A. And what happens is after the vote, remember I told you about the BMX room where the cards run through the hopper onto a magnetic disc, a computer disc? Well, there... They take, not only do they, that card goes from a precinct to a central point, then it goes from the central point where all these precincts meet, like, say, a high school. It's driven down to wherever your mainframe, wherever the League of Women Voters or people like that are tampering with it, and put onto the BMX machine, onto the tape. Then it's driven to Downey. That tape, I mean, here's a ballot security, man. That tape, or maybe a dozen other tapes, or maybe the tape just disappears into the void, is driven to Downey, California, where it's then given out to the public. Now, is that the way a vote should be handled?
Now, according to the law, citizens should be able to observe the vote counting process.
Right. You want to follow the tape to Downey? You know, let's get 10,000 citizens out there in cars and follow the tape to Downey, where it's run out for the television stations to see.
So what we would be looking for, they don't have to not to have the computer down anymore, right?
No,
that's not the current.
That's interesting. I don't know if it happens. I know it has happened out there, but perhaps when they run it onto the tape, that it's all real. And at the point where you see a candidate who shouldn't be winning, that's where they can change that Downey tape. That's the part of the investigation I can't get any farther into, because nobody can see that it disappears. And
by law, we should be able to see that.
Oh, by law, that shouldn't even be there. That's a secret count. And anybody who allows that type of process, and that's Tom Hayden, who knows all about it. Hayden knows how that works, and he hasn't said a word. I don't care what type of baggage his Vietnam career might have been to me in my investigation. He should have opened his mouth and said something. That's why I think the man doesn't deserve to climb over the backs of all the people he's done with Jane's money.
Well, one question that occurred to me that I'm sure is occurring to people. If the elections are rigged, how come Bush lost the presidential election?
Oh, because Bush by that time was an anathema to the people of this country. Nobody would have possibly believed. Plus, For those people who understand the CFR and the trilateralists, Reader's Digest printed a list of who they are, and there's a place in Texas who named them all. Donna Shalala is one of them, and it's got the whole list. He's on there. He's a CFR man. And so he's no different. They're just... we did a story in there. We tried to get all the men. And so he's no different. They're just... we did a story in there. We tried to get all the conspirators in one room. I mean, Ken and I would go through these fantasies, because in Miami we found all the conspirators in one room there in violation of what's called the Sunshine Law. I think you might have it there too. And what it was is that the Chamber of Commerce heads and the heads of all the media met in Miami in one room, and they would get the city council members in to tell them how to vote. They'd meet on Monday and tell these guys how to vote on Wednesday, and they'd go in and have a charade on Wednesday about voting, but it was all set up. So when we went to Washington and were suing people and pursuing the investigation in Washington, we said, wouldn't it be great if we could find the heads of all the media, ABC, CBS, NBC, Catherine Graham of the Washington Post, who is the most powerful woman in America, and the head of the Republican National Committee and the head of the Democratic National Committee, all in one room. Well, we did. And we print the transcript of the meeting. They had meetings once a month. And that's one of the most fascinating bits. You know, we sent this book to get a Pulitzer at Columbia University, and I'm sure that we won't get it. But for the original reporting, it should be gotten, because just getting that one report would put them all in the room, quoted them saying, there's no media here in this room, and so we can talk freely. And what they did at that meeting was they got rid of the League of Women Voters, because we were suing them as being sponsors of the presidential debate. And this is another story that's never been printed anywhere, why and how they stopped the league from sponsoring national television debates.
Yes, this was now at this meeting they said in the transcript, Robert Strauss, former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, reminded the group of assembled notables that confidentiality was the order of the day. He put it this way, quote, "Let me say that there's no press in here today. There will be none today, so we can speak with some considerable candor," unquote. And in that room where there's no press was Catherine Graham, chairwoman of the board of the Washington Post.
Post Newsweek.
And Newsweek. Lawrence Grossman, president of NBC News, president of Public Broadcasting Service. Rune Arledge. A recently named group president for ABC News, producer of World News Tonight, 2020 Nightline, and Viewpoint, and on, as a William...
And both Republican and National Committee heads. So people who think that how come Democrats get this or Republicans, there's no such thing. They're Republicrats at the top, and they don't care. The people below them are just... The politicians are fodder for their game, and there is no labels at the top. There are no liberals, there are no conservatives, there's just rich people at the top.
And no media.
And no media, right. These media heads are no media. They don't consider themselves media. They don't consider themselves news people. They consider themselves power brokers.
Yeah.
And gods. Literally gods. And the most powerful people in the country and the richest. You can't beat them. I mean, you can say Lee Iacocca. He's nothing. Nothing. The media heads are the power. The head of the Detroit News or the Knight Ridder chain can destroy an Iacocca. Industrialists mean nothing. Perot means nothing. They got enough on him on taxes to crush him anytime they want. But the media people, there's the power. There's the richness. There's the country club set. And that's why Jane Fonda went with Ted Turner. And that's why Hayden's keeping his mouth shut.
You know, CNN is part of this consortium that...
No, absolutely. We went to Ed Turner, the brother of Ted Turner, and he just says... let's just say he's an insulting man.
We are talking with James Collier, co-author with his brother Kenneth Collier, of Vote Scam, The Stealing of America, which is now 6 months old as of March 24th, 1994. You want to take some phone calls?
Sure.
I'm going to assiduously attempt to not hang up on you at this point.
Okay.
And
you do call
open
back.
Up, yeah, and open up the conference line. And if it is March 24th, 1994, where you are, you can talk with James Collier about Vote Scam at KPFK.
I don't know.
Okay. Hello, you're on the air.
Mr. Collier.
Yes.
I'm extremely impressed with this report. It's scandalous. It's shocking. But I have to ask you one thing. With all due respect, if what you're saying is true, why haven't they tried to eliminate you or your brother?
Well, they tried. We talk about it in Miami. They tried once. After that, we scattered the story nationwide to the spotlight, and our demise, I suspect, would have been like Danny Casolaro. Somebody out there would have made a bigger stink. So, and now, of course, the book is out, and 10,000 copies are across the country, and then another 10 are about to come off the press. So anything happens to me, they'd have to get my two brothers, my wife and my daughter, and a host of people at Victoria House Press who would step from behind the curtain. And so I don't think they're going to do that now.
I think that's what's happened to the liberals. They're all scared of being hit. And because this question always pops up whenever anybody is doing something important, investigating.
Now, liberals get murdered.
Instead of a stenography reporter, the question always pops up, why aren't you dead?
Right. We say that in the book, the two questions that are asked most by everybody. We say that right in the book is, have you gone to 60 Minutes and aren't you afraid they're going to kill you?
Mm-hmm.
And there's your first question.
Okay, second question. You're on the air?
Yes. Back in 1992, I was doing research for Jerry Brown's presidential campaign, and I came across the book by Jonathan Bankin and the article about vote scam.
Right, Bankin did a great piece on it.
A copy of that over to Eli Miller, and eventually he tracked you down,
that's
I believe.
Right. That's
and
exactly
got a copy
how it happened. You did that.
Your manuscript, Jerry
Brown.
Where did
Eli Miller go?
And I don't know from what you said, Jerry Brown once got the word out about that, but I didn't get any feedback directly, you know, that he got any information out about.
Well, do you know where Eli Miller went?
I got a call from him maybe about 9 months ago, and I might be able to dig up that phone number.
Well,
but I'm
call
not sure
him and tell him to get a hold of me at Victoria House Press in New York, because I want to do an update on the third printing of the book and find out what happened. Why did he get fired by Brown?
I was told, this is what I was told, okay, this is what he told me. He was claiming that there were a number of women in the organization, in the Jerry Brown for President campaign, that claimed that he was sexist, and he didn't feel comfortable, they didn't feel comfortable going into his office, and he was making snide remarks and things like that.
Oh, well,
that's
poor guy.
What he told me. I have no idea whether that's true.
Right. Well, anyway, I appreciate you getting the Bankin book, because Bankin did a great book called The Conspiracies, Crimes, and Cover-Ups. And
right, that's the book I'm talking
in
about.
There. We're in there.
Right, that's where I originally saw the article on it, and we got a hold of Bankin, and Bankin, from there, Eli eventually got a hold of you, I believe.
Right, and that's how I got to actually to Geraldo Rivera through that, because Herrera got, Bankin's book, and they mm-hmm. called up, and we got an undercover camera.
Mm-hmm.
And
I also
Anderson.
Worked on Tom Hayden's Senate campaign in 1976 full-time, so I have connected both. I can give you my phone number.
Well, don't do it on here. Call Victoria House Press in New York at 323-7907.
Let me have that once more, please.
323-7907, area code 212. And anyone else who needs to get a hold of me for serious reasons, I don't want to just hear how elections are rigged. Don't bother with that, I know. If you got anything more important to say, tell me. But call me there and give me that. And if you can get a hold of Tom and a tape, can you get a tape of this show? Is that available, the tape of this show?
Yes. Tom listens sometimes, I've heard.
Right. Well, someone get it to him because...
Well, I am sending him information, lists of grassroots organizations in Southern California, other stuff, if...
Well, this is a challenge to Tom, and, you know, I'm in his book, Reunion.
Mm-hmm.
And I always, if you read Reunion, you will see, I think Tom is trying to get even with me for stealing his girlfriend in, when we were in the 12th grade.
Okay.
I think he's still smarting over it. And I think it's time to put away the hatchets. It is time for him to act like a man and get out there and talk to the people about this. And he's got the book. We sent it to him, and he wouldn't even acknowledge it. It's about time that the people take back this government and not give it away to guys like Hayden, who are just out there thinking that their $10 million can buy you and he can buy DFM and he can keep his mouth shut. It's time to stand up and be counted. And if I sound mad as hell and don't want to take it anymore, I am.
Okay.
I think the people out there should be. Every time you go vote now, you're just wasting the time. You're playing into their hands of the TV stations and the net and the LA Times and the people,
you know,
that control you. And you should call up everybody you know, everybody listening.
You know that Jerry Brown is now on 50 talk radio shows all over the country. He's syndicated. And
Jerry
Brown. You know, his address or phone number up in San Francisco, if you'd want to further contact him, I don't know.
No, it's no good if I do it. It's only if people contact him and say that the man shouldn't be running for the governor if he knows this. And if he is, he should blow the whistle on this. This isn't a joke. This is how our nation has been looted, systematically looted. The pension funds, the Social Security are all looted, broke. The SNLs, and they're systematically looting this country, because when you rig elections, not only do you put politicians in who will play ball, you put judges in. And judges in California are notorious for stealing probate. When people die, the judges and select law firms. Anyone doubts that, get Rodney Stitch's book, Defrauding America. What they did to Rodney Stitch, and he documents and names the law firms out of San Francisco who stripped him of millions because he was the whistleblower on the aeronautic industry, where planes were crashing because they weren't doing right.
What do you think of Martin Gross's new book, A Call for Revolution?
Thank you.
I haven't read it yet. If it has anything to do with this, I tell you, one of the things I learned is that there's the patriots, the people who call them the patriots, the Beau Greitz people, they're armed and they're angry. And I went to them or tried to get to them through people saying, that's not the way to go. The original book that we proposed to Dell in 1970 was running through the system ballots, not bullets. But these people are advocating bullets to take over this country and bring it back. I don't believe that's the way. I believe it's the ballot. Paper ballots in see-through plastic boxes. If you can rig that, you deserve it. But that's why India, Israel, England, Russia all use paper ballots. Nobody is as stupid as this country to allow computers and print-o-matics, with you can't look in the backs of the machines and you crank out a paper, to run this country. And then you wonder why we're losing jobs. Why? I mean, I'm angry.
We're losing
and I want to go out there and tell people, and I think people got to buy the book and wave it under people's noses and tell them not to go to the polls anymore until there's a revolution.
We're losing jobs. We're losing money. We're getting sprayed with poison. They're taking away our vitamins and our food supplements.
All of that, and there's no way to stop them. Look what Clinton did with NAFTA. Look how the gall of Reno to go in and incinerate people.
Yeah,
and no one can do
yeah.
anything, and the media all playing a part, can't say anything, can't attack, because they're rigging the elections. You go to the L.A. Times and tell them I told them they're rigging elections, and I want to talk to the editor about it. Is Norman Chandler and those guys still running that paper?
Yeah.
I want a meeting with them if they have any doubts of what I'm accusing them of.
Hello, you're on the air with James Collier.
Hi, yeah. This is great, because I've had the most unsatisfying feeling about those cards with the holes in them that I can't read what I've just punched in, you know.
Right.
But besides the lack of satisfaction from the act of voting, it seems to me that the widest possible distribution of these ideas practically demands two things. And one is that the book be placed in libraries. Would it help if we ordered it at all of our local
libraries?
Sure,
absolutely.
And the other thing is the possibility of making a video, because it seems to me that that's the only way ideas ever get disseminated in the...
Yeah, well, I have a video. The video I have, and we're putting it together, is going to have the one that Pat Robertson showed how they did it in Miami, because it's the same, they do it the same way where you are. And it's going to include the Kennedy, the sniper's nest in Dallas. And eventually we'll have that for sale, and I'll be using it on a lecture tour if I get out to California. And I'm ready to hit the road now and go anywhere, and I definitely want to confront Tom Hayden.
Well, you've done a wonderful and hopeful thing, and thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Hello, you're on the air with James Collier.
Thank you. I enjoyed reading the book. Didn't enjoy it, actually. It's not the right term.
It's disheartening, but it's crucial.
Yeah, it's as disheartening as the Christic Institute reading list.
Yeah, you know, I went to the Christic Institute. What was that name?
Sheehan.
Sheehan, yeah, right. And he was so involved with what he was doing at the time, we were all in Washington together, that he couldn't do anything. And I was on a radio show up in Portland. One of his guys has a show up there, too. We tried to get it to, but they couldn't go any farther. They wouldn't join us.
Yeah, there are a lot of demands on his time. I had a question about the Print-O-Matic, and it's still in use, is it?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So from what I read in the book, then this presupposes that the wheels are preset for certain candidates.
No, not that the wheels, that the... Oh, yes, the wheels are preset, and then the piece of paper, already has the numbers on it.
Uh-huh. So what's to prevent some nice campaign, or rather vote counter, from cranking that handle twice and without anybody having voted and having it spit out preset numbers?
Even if it did, like there's a woman in Waterloo, Iowa, who read the book. She has a public access TV show there, and she's on the school board, Elaine Jakewith. She read the book, and she said, wow, it says here that you're never going to be able to look in the back of those machines. And she went to the elections division there and said, I want to look in the back of the machines. And they said, when hell freezes over. And so she went on her public access TV show and caused such a stink that the local paper tried to drive her out of town, said she was a troublemaker. But she kept it up. And so they went. They said, all right, we'll get rid of these print-o-matics. And they brought in the computer, or we'll bring it in. And that she called me up, and she said, wow, I won. And I said, well, but you got the computer. So they made such a stink about the computer, because they want to go to paper ballots, that they went back to the print-o-matic. So she's back in the frying pan.
My question was, couldn't they crank the handle twice and get it to show that it's been preset?
Yeah, but even if someone did that, are you going to go to the local newspaper?
Well, I don't know. At least the election workers
might walk. So a couple people will walk off the job like they did in Miami.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay, well,
4,000 walked off in Miami, and it didn't mean a thing. The Herald just said there was a snafu.
How many thousand walked out?
600 precincts.
Hello?
And yeah. 12 people in each, whatever.
4,000 electoral workers who refused to participate in a vote fraud walked off the job.
Right.
And we haven't heard anything about that.
No, but you can. Anybody who cares can research the Miami Herald, 1973, 74, and the story's there.
Hello, you're on the air with James Collier.
Good morning. I want to recommend a book. I just got it. It's Behold a Pale Horse by William Cooper.
Naval Intelligence.
Yeah.
Thank you. Hello, you're on the air. Hello.
You lost the...
Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, I just wanted to make a comment. The Boog Rights followers, there has been some division in some of the ranks with the Patriot community, and people like Linda Thompson don't like Boog Rights. They think that he's a Trojan horse, and he infiltrated the intelligence or the right. The Patriot community.
All right. For people who don't know, Linda Thompson has the Waco tape.
That's right. That's right.
Video.
Linda Thompson was also on Frank Sontag last Sunday. It was one of the best shows he ever did.
Uh-huh.
And also I know, you know, Bill Cooper isn't a very reputable word here on Roy's show, but I do listen to his show on shortwave, even though he's considered dysfunctional and caustic. And you know, I've cross-referenced some of his information, and it's still pretty good. I don't agree with everything he says, but he also had Linda Thompson on his show, and you know, they both don't like Bo Grits. They call him Bobo Grits, But
right, well, that's what I'm saying. Bogreitz is dangerous because he's advocating bullets, and I'm advocating ballots.
Yeah, that's true. And also, the Patriot community now, the movement is that since their bedrock doctrine is the Constitution, they're forming militias and saying, you know, it's within our constitutional rights to bear arms, and
right,
and we're going to arm ourselves,
and
if we're attacked, the laws on our side, that we're going to fight.
It isn't going to go away.
Yeah.
And the more that they realize what's going on, the more they're going to have some type of righteous indignation that's going to keep growing, and the more they try to take guns away, the bigger they're going to grow.
Do you feel that what's happening in the country on all fronts, as far as, health freedom, people being attacked, Randy Weaver, Donald Scott, Waco, it's happening in different
absolutely
venues.
There's
it's all
assassination
the same
squad
methodology, isn't it?
For sure. Danny Casolaro, they will. Weaver, all those people. The federal government is a killing agency, and it will kill anybody who stands in their way.
Okay, thanks for your call. Hello, you're on the air with James Collier.
Yeah, thanks a lot for this great interview here. I'm sure, Mr. Collier, you're familiar with Jack Thompson.
Yeah, Jack and I know each other from Miami, and Jack is the guy, for people who don't know, who knew Janet Reno real well, and he was crusading that Janet Reno was a lesbian, had lesbian affairs, could prove it, was drunk DWI in Miami, and kept all the Metro cops from prosecuting, from stating that she was, because she'd get them all fired. And, of course, Biden didn't want to hear any of that.
Yeah, well, he was just out here yesterday.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we have a thing out here called the Granada Pavilion. They have all these Patriots come out, and he calls Janet Reno Hitler in drag.
Yeah, I know. He hates her.
And the one thing I don't understand is why liberals, if you excuse me, like Roy, and we have another girl he broadcast called Marlena Smith, they look up to these. Roy and Marlena must know she's a lesbian. And they look
well,
up to her as some kind of a hero.
I don't care what she does in her spare time. That was not my issue. My issue was that she obstructed justice and is continuing to do so in federal offense on these election rigging charges, and that she protects election riggers nationwide because the Justice Department could blow this thing right open tomorrow, and that the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee is doing the same thing.
Well, let me ask one thing real quick, and I'll get out of the way here. We have a very important election coming up here, April 12th, to get rid of Fatso Roberti.
Uh-huh.
And there's only about 40-something thousand people that are allowed to vote in this election, but it will send a very strong message across the country against gun control.
Uh-huh.
And the L.A. Times has been going bananas on this for the last couple of weeks. Do you think, on a very small-sized election, like just a local assembly district, do you think that the possibility for election fraud is
absolutely
very large in a very important little election
if
like this?
The only question is, do they choose to do it? Not whether it's there. They can do it any time they choose to do it. And that's what I object to, not whether they say, well, then how come if the L.A. Times was against it that it won? I can't answer questions like that. What I can say is if the citizens of this country allow the either-or position to exist, we'll rig it or we won't, it's up to the board. That's sick. That is really sick. And people, the 40,000 people who are going to vote in that shouldn't vote. As soon as and 40,000 votes will still be cast whether they went to the polls or not.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't make any difference. But I know there's the person out there listening to me right now that says, it doesn't make any difference. It's the only thing I ever do is vote, and I don't care if it's rigged. It's my civic duty. I'm going to tell my friends I vote. And that kind of mentality is what is looting this country, allowing the looters to loot it, allowing the riggers to rig it.
Well, if they
because
say
people
a certain amount of people vote anyway, even if they don't, and how does that help anything? In other words, if nobody votes and they say 40,000 people voted.
I know. Well, you know what happened? Interesting. People have been calling me from various cities like Las Vegas and Des Moines, where they counted people who went to the polls. In the United States, about 1,000 people per precinct, it's gridded off that way, are allowed to vote.
And so they counted 700 people walking into the polls, but 900 voted officially. And so I got a call from Des Moines, Iowa on that. And then the next day I got a call from Las Vegas, and the same thing happened there and in Texas. So it's a new phenomenon that the election supervisors are doing. They're letting 700 or 800 people vote, but then the overage up to the 1,000, they're saying voted. And if people sat outside the polls and counted in California, you'd probably find the same thing. So the numbers mean nothing.
Hello, you're on the air with James Collier.
Oh, hi. I think this is just really wonderful stuff. I intend to get the book and force my library into buying it, too. But the thing that really tipped me off to some of this is Janet Reno couldn't find any organized crime in Dade County, Florida. I just blew me away. And another thing, too, is the League of Women Voters is just really an arm of, it isn't just the Democratic Party, but generally speaking.
Yeah, let me tell you something about that.
Establishment
types,
the League of Women Voters, city councils, all the way up and down.
Every single corporation in America that's major, the oil companies, all the major companies give millions to the League's coffers. They get paid by the television networks to be the field personnel on this so-called calling in. And by the way, we haven't even told you how corrupt the exit polls are. I didn't even get into that in the show.
That's
forgot
right.
About it.
There are no exit polls.
There are no exit polls, right. That's the not proper area of inquiry when you look into it. That's every, you know, when they come on at 7 o'clock and tell you who won, that's supposedly based on exit polls, and they're totally a fraud. Anyway, the league gets that, and they're in the counties nationwide where the vote card is, and they're tampering with them in one way or the other, or just sitting there pretending to be busy, and getting $40 per head per hour to the national coffers. The volunteers get nothing, but they're counted. If there's 100 volunteers, then $40 per 100 per hour. If they sit there 4 hours on election night, go to the national coffers. So the league is just
nonpartisan.
Ah,
but the reality
you can get,
you know,
they have total,
you know,
agendas, and this money that
the reality,
they get, $40 per head per hour, is illegal. It's unbid taxpayer money.
Okay. Well, our tempest is fugiting, James.
Yes.
So and we'll give the information out again. We have been talking with James M. Collier, who, with his brother Kenneth F. Collier, has written Vote Scam, The Stealing of America. And that is the book, Vote Scam, The Stealing of America, by James M. Collier and Kenneth F. Collier. It is generally available and orderable through your local bookstore. It definitely is at the Mandala Bookstore in Santa Monica at 6th and Santa Monica. Telephone area 310-393-1953. And if they want to order, if someone's local bookstore doesn't have it, they can order it through Victoria House Press, 67 Wall Street in New York, or what was it?
10005.
10005.
Right.
And the other, the distributor?
The national distributor for bookstores is Baker and Taylor. So if your bookstore doesn't have it, just say call up Baker and Taylor. They've got it. Or Golden Lee. Baker and Taylor or Golden Lee.
Okay, Vote Scam, The Stealing of America by James and Kenneth Collier. Well, I hope you sell an extra 30 million of these, and because your documentation is very impressive, and although it's disheartening to be faced with this huge, overwhelming problem, it's also very encouraging that it has been uncovered, and that when people hear about this and read about this, they will be mad enough to not want to take it anymore. I hope.
Right, me too.
Okay, so thanks for the great book, and we hope that we can maybe get our elections back.
All right, thank you, sir.
Good night.